When people come, become interested in the gospel and message of Jesus Christ and the kingdom of God, they should want to first prove that God does exist. One reason is because there is no escaping the constant barrage of the teaching that evolution is a proven fact, which of course means there's no need for God. This philosophical teaching is ingrained throughout every area of our culture today. Man explains everything about life and existence based on evolution. We're all here today because we have proved to ourselves that God does exist and that he is real, and that he is not just a religious idea. As a Christian, though, can we answer some of the major evolutionary arguments that are taught to our children in school or that we are confronted with on occasions? In some cases, a lot of people do not have much of a background to know what to say. Today, I would like to look at some of the major problems in evolution and also look at some of the major evidences for God that we need to be aware of both and be able to expound both when such a time arises for us. First, does it matter one way or the other? Some people, including religious people, will ask or say that it really doesn't matter one way or the other, because in some cases, in various churches, they believe in what is called theistic evolution, that God created through evolution everything that we have. So to them, what difference does it make? It does make a lot of difference, and it makes a lot of difference to us. If there is no God, then we are just the product of time and chance. We do not have to give any regard to God or to his word if he does not exist. We have no purpose for being on this earth. This life is all there is, and there is no hope for eternal life. Now, on the other hand, if God does exist, then we are not an accident. We are meant to be here. There is a purpose for our existence. We are responsible to our Creator. We realize there is hope to live beyond this life. Quite a contrast. So if, first of all, the question should come up, what difference does it make? It makes a lot of difference. It really does. All the difference in the world, as we might say. Well, since it does matter, then what are some of the major problems with evolution that we should look at and be aware of, and not in any way be feeling intimidated because they are people who, well, I'm a scientist. You don't question a scientist. You know, people who are professionals in certain areas, they want to kind of, at least not all of them, but some of them, they do not want to be questioned. Sometimes doctors don't want to be questioned. I'm a doctor, of course, don't you know? Or lawyers. I'm glad that Linda's not here. And she's not that way, by the way. But sometimes you have that, because we've had people who have had experiences with lawyers in which they did say and would say to them, well, are you a lawyer? Well, no. Well, then how do you know? What? You don't know the law. And this type of thing. Well, I give you that because it's important, and we should not be intimidated. We should recognize that there are major problems. And a lot of times those problems are never addressed. And they're glossed over and moving on to believe things that, frankly, are not true. The first big problem with the teaching of evolution comes down to the question, is it science or is it philosophy? Science or philosophy? I have a book entitled The 10 Things That You Should Know About the Creation Versus Evolution Debate by Ron Rhodes. There's a subtitle, Evolution Rests on the Foundation of Naturalism. Evolution rests on the foundation of naturalism. That is, no God, everything is explained by natural causes. And is that really true? Is that really true? That's true for them. That is, that's what they choose to believe. But is it provable, scientifically provable, that that is the case? No, it isn't. It is philosophy. Let me read a couple things on this point here from this very interesting book. You don't have to have a huge, thick book like this to be able to find out what are some of the major problems. In fact, the simpler it is, the easier and the better it is to understand. When people get things real complicated, they want it to be complicated so that you will not see where the flaws are. Naturalism is a system of thought that espouses the idea that all phenomena in the universe can be explained wholly in terms of natural causes and laws. Going on here about naturalism, naturalism virtually rules the academic world. Its presence is oppressively felt in public schools, colleges, and universities across the country. Naturalism has been called the, quote, default position for all serious inquiry, and predominates in education, law, the arts, and, of course, science. Many of today's intellectual attacks against the Bible and Christianity and creationism are rooted in naturalism. That there can be no supernatural, there are no miracles, there is no God. Have you ever watched a documentary on the National Geographic Channel? Or on anything, on Animal Planet, and about the animals and how they came to be? Everything will be based as far as it's interesting. I do watch these shows. They show some very interesting things. They really show how great God is, but they all explain how it evolved to where it is at the present time that you're looking at it. By naturalism. Natural, this is all be explained and reasoned as natural causes. Well, that really is not the case whatsoever. I have another little book that's very interesting, Defeating Darwinism by Opening Minds. There have been a lot of minds that have been closed. The author is Philip E. Johnson. Philip E. Johnson is a professor. He is also a debater of intelligent design. He teaches out in San Diego at one of the universities there, and I didn't get the name. He gave it here, and I didn't get it down, but it doesn't matter. He's quite active. He's written some very, very interesting books. He's known by many and has debated many, including Richard Dawkins, who he has personally discussed things with. Richard Dawkins is one of the big-named evolutionists in the world today from Britain. In his book, he also carries on here just a little bit as to what Rhodes was saying in his book. And let me just share a couple things here with you on that, and then we'll move along. Because it's important to understand when you begin to get into the subject, you're dealing with philosophy. Philosophy of what people want to believe, not that anything can be observed and demonstrated and shown to be scientifically so. Yet science, many times, it's called science when it is not. It is actually philosophy that people choose to follow. Now, Johnson here writing says, evolution is not a fact, it's a philosophy. The materialism comes from a priori, and the evidence is interpreted in light of that unchangeable philosophical commitment. If the evidence seems to go against the philosophy, so much the worse for the evidence. To a materialist, putting up with any amount of bad practice in science is better than to let that divine foot in the door. The divine foot, of course, being God. And that's really true. Now, why do you think that might be? Because many times when you read any of these things, individuals, it doesn't matter what is presented or the questions asked, it is like a religion. It is like a religion. And we're going to see as we go along and look at some of the other flaws here in a minute, there is no bending of the approach. That is, that's it. I recall one professor I had in college many, many years ago in Portland State talking and trying to appease this big class here of over 100 of us and simply saying, now, we do know at one time the earth was covered with water, just like it says in the Bible. But nevertheless, we know that man has descended from the apes. Did you present any evidence to us in that class? None whatsoever. And I will come to that later. All right. A couple scriptures here before we move on to the next point. In Romans chapter 8 and in verse 7. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? Certainly not. On the contrary, I would have known. I have the wrong one here. Chapter 8, okay. I was in chapter 7. Now, chapter 8, verse 7. Because the carnal mind is enmity against God, for it is not subject to the law of God, nor indeed can be. That's a very important statement. Mr. Armstrong used to use that many times years and years ago in the 60s when I was listening or just coming into the church, and I would hear that. Yes, the carnal mind is enmity toward God. It does not want to submit to the idea of God in its life. And you find this, that really it comes down not to science. It comes down to this philosophy that I will not believe in anything supernatural, anything as far as a miracle. Another scripture that applies in this case as well is in Jeremiah 17 and in verse 9. These are scriptures you used to see a lot of times in our writings. We haven't used them, at least I haven't seen them here in recent times. But in Jeremiah chapter 17 and in verse 9, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? Yes, I don't care if you are a PhD, multiple PhDs, the heart is still deceitful above all things. The carnal mind is enmity toward God, no matter how many degrees you have after your name, how many books, it doesn't make any difference how many books you have written. When there is this kind of almost like a blind faith, no matter what is shown that it's impossible to have happened, I'm going to believe it anyhow. And that is very sad when you see that. All right, so the first thing, one of the first major problems to look at that with evolution is the fact that it is not science. It is philosophy. Wanting to believe in the natural or materialistic philosophy of all things, and that there is can never possibly be anything of spirit or a God behind the creation and everything that we see. That, first of all, that's the premise. That's the foundation that is being they start with. But they call it science, and yet that really is not what science is. Now let's move on to several other things here. One of the other major problems is that microevolution is not macroevolution. Now, probably you're wondering, what am I talking about here? Well, we experience in our lifetime, and we see it, microevolution. That is, life forms make adjustments because of climate, weather, food sources, and that type of thing. How many of you have a dog or a cat? You do, don't you? A lot of you. You notice that there are many different breeds and types. It's called microevolution. Have you ever seen one of those different breeds become an entirely different species? No, it's never happened. If it did, that would be macroevolution. Macroevolution does not happen. It does not take place. You cannot observe it. You cannot find it in the fossil record, in the strata. And that's one of the biggest flaws of evolution. There is no evidence of it whatsoever. And we need to know that. Because when your child comes home from school and they heard the story that started with Charles Darwin on the Galapagos Islands, which is still taught today, looking at the finch bird, that as the weather and the feeding conditions change, the beak of the finch will change. I even saw this on, I think it was National Geographic, the actor was with a scientist, and Arkin, is that his name, Alan Arkin, or maybe I've got the wrong name there, and he was so excited because the biologist was showing him, now see right here, would you look at this little finch, how his beak has changed? That is evolution right there taking place. That is fraud taking place. Because that biologist knows very good and well there has never been a finch that has turned into anything else but a finch. And yes, the beak will adjust because if there's lack of food or weather conditions or whatever, there is adaptability. But there is never ever a change into a never, into another species. That finch will continue to be a finch, a bird, nothing else. And later, when the conditions of the weather and the food supplies or whatever change to where it will adapt back, where its beak will begin to change to be able to feed itself better because the conditions have changed. God built that in. That's why we have all these different types and varieties. Let's take cats. We have two cats. I've told you that many, many times. I'm waiting to see the big cat crossing the alley out there. And you know which one that is, the panther. And all kinds of different varieties of cats, but cats are cats. We had a panther over there in Fort Myers here just, two months ago, whenever it was, a three-year-old male looking for new territory. He comes into Six Mile Island Preserve, sometimes right near where we meet for church. And that's a place where you take walk through nature trails and everything. And they showed it in pictures in the news press. Here's this huge, big panther, walks up in front of the nature center area. He's looking around and sits down just like a cat sits, a house cat. I never have seen a huge cat like that, but he exactly in many ways does the same thing as other cats. Anyhow, let me move on. That, the fact that you have all those varieties would come under microevolution. Microevolution is not macroevolution. Macroevolution has never happened. Even though they will say it has, you parents tell your son or daughter, go back and ask the teacher, can you show me one example of macroevolution? You said it has happened and resulted in what we are here today. Show, where is there an example so we can see it? Well, you cannot answer the question. What, are you dabbling in religion? A lot of times it's a matter to attack the source because you can't answer the question. And try to pawn it off that it's, well, just being religious is what. No, can you answer the question, though? Can you answer the question? Where would you go to see an example of macroevolution, either in the fossil record or today, anywhere? That is one of the major problems that you will find. And if you have to answer questions, ask them, where is it? It does not happen. It never has happened. Let's move on to a third one. There are no intermediate fossils showing a transition of one species into another. That overlaps, of course, with macroevolution because there is none. Once again, let me read from Rhodes' book. I think it's very interesting. There is not, this is a big deal. Darwin also understood this. Darwin's point in 1859 in Origin of Species was that he realized there were no intermediate species, but given enough time, we will find them. We will find them. It is a problem. He admitted that. That there should be evidence of the evolution, the changing by natural selection from one species into another. 150 plus years or whatever it is now has gone by, and guess what? They have not found any intermediate species in the fossil strata showing clearly that one is changing and growing or evolving into something else. And that is a major problem. Let me read here again. I mentioned from Rhodes' book. I thought it was quite interesting. Evolution's big problem, no intermediate fossils. The more one studies the fossil records, the more one finds a lack of evidence to support evolution. If evolution were true, one would expect to see in the fossil records progressively complex evolutionary forms, indicating transitions of one life form into another. We should see fish transitioning into reptiles, and some ancient ancestor life form transitioning into apes and thus into humans. However, out of all the billions of fossils known and documented in the rocks of the Earth's crust, no such evidence exists. Get this. The British Museum of History alone contains some 60 million fossil specimens, yet not one is a transitional form showing one species evolving into another. 60 million fossils in the British Museum of History. Rather, the evidence reveals a sudden appearance of life forms, and each of them exhibits all the features that distinguish that life form. Fully formed and fully functional, with no evolving of body parts involved, we find no ancestors with stubs on their lower bodies that gave rise to species with legs. We find no ancestors with stubs on their sides that gave rise to species with wings. Such Darwinian gradualism is completely absurd. And that's important so that you can tell that to somebody else, or you can tell that to your own children when they come home from school and found out that in elementary school this was being taught to them. And yet there is absolutely no evidence in the fossil record. The fossil strata, the oldest one with life in it, is called the Cambrian strata. The Cambrian strata is also, it is the explosion of biological life. And going below the Cambrian strata, the Precambrian strata, there is nothing. There is nothing. It is an amazing thing. In fact, I think you've been there too. When we were in college, we got to go out during semester break to Pasadena. And on the way back, we'd stop at the Grand Canyon. And on the south rim, this is 1967 or 8 when I was there. On the south rim, if you take a left and go west on it, you go down to the point called Hermit's Rest. And the signs were there. I don't know what it's like today, but in that period of time, signs were all around, don't pick up the fossils. And what were the fossils? Cambrian fossils, all these trilobites that are extinct, all whole. They're sticking out of the rocks. They're laying on the ground. They're everywhere. And it became, in fact, the Cambrian strata, the first strata where you have complete life. It's called an explosion, as I think I just said. It's also called the Big Bang of biology because you can't explain it. Can't explain it. There you had absolutely everything, and there was no transitions. Everything was complete for that age of time, which was long before man was created and put on the earth. Let me move along here because I'll keep up, watch my time. Another major problem that we should be aware of and should not in any way be fooled by this, and I've heard scientists on documentaries, I've heard it on TV, will use this one, and it is fraudulent to use it. And that is, mutations do not bring about new species. Mutations do not bring about new species. And yet, that many times is taught, nobody questions it, and so it's accepted. Most mutations are not beneficial to the creature, but are even, in most cases, harmful. They take place in existing organisms, and they do not produce a new species. They do not produce a new species. Once again, I'm going to read here from Rhodes on that, because if they do, where's the evidence? We should be able to find it, shouldn't we? Well, the evidence is there is no evidence. You cannot expect, and he prefaces what I'm about to read here, with naturalism, that is, with natural selection. If there is no God, if there is, then how would, through natural selection, would you have mutations take place to form all kinds of life? Do you realize how many mutations would have to take place for your eye to form? And during all the years that it was taking and the mutations are going on from generation to generation to finally form your eye, when there is no God, there is nothing there guiding it, it's just time and chance. And yet it's mutating into something that in millions of years, bam, you're going to be able to see in color. That was one of the things Darwin wrestled over, was the eye. Now, you don't need to stop with the eye. How about all of the major organs of the human body or an animal body? But let's take human body. And, of course, of all of them, the brain. The brain. The brain just, all the mutation, 3 trillion mutations to come to the brain that you have today. A lot of times young people are told, well, these things were happened by natural selection and through mutation, not telling them what it would take, how many mutations it would take to get to where you are today. Now, you ought to see this going on right now. The evidence ought to be out there. Anyone could go out and look at it, seeing how, well, look at here, now look at there. Well, it's just not that way. Evolution has no intelligent, deterministic element about it, because they don't believe in God. So, okay, so how can you? There's no intelligence that would cause all of these millions, literally, of mutations to develop our body organs. They all have to function together, by the way, in order for us to live and be able to reproduce and continue on and on. You can't just have one organ that is having mutations, is developing, and the rest of it's not. They're dependent upon one another. It all has to be together. Let me read a couple things here. Because natural selection is a mindless, blind, unconscious, purposeless process, it is not capable of making and fulfilling long-range goals. And if it cannot make and fulfill long-range goals, how could natural selection bring about the development of an eye, step by step, generation by generation, over a long period of time? Such a concept stretches the limits of credulity. To compound the problem, the eye is only one among many complex organs in a human being. What about the ear? What about the brain? What about the heart, the liver, the kidney, the nervous system, the nose with its sense of smell? Are we to believe that again and again, natural selection blindly and mindlessly brought about complex organs via a step-by-step, generation-by-generation process over a long period of time? No wonder Darwin expressed doubts about how this could work. To imagine that natural selection could blindly and mindlessly construct a complex organ like an eye or ear makes about as much sense as imagining that dropping my television would result in an improved version. Well, you know, a lot of times when people go to college and they have professors and individuals want to challenge them, they need to question the values of your parents, question the values maybe that you're taught in school of your country and so forth. They never, how many students really stop and say, when I begin to hear this kind of thing, maybe I ought to question him and what he is saying? And is it really true? Can it be backed up with science? Or is it just speaking off the top of his head and philosophy? Well, mutations do not bring about a new species. All you have to do is ask, let's see the proof. They cannot produce it. It's not there. Yet they'll still preach it as though, I mean, because it's a philosophy, as though it's a fact, when they cannot back it up. All right, moving on. Number 5. Ape men do not prove evolution. Ape men do not prove evolution. Over the years that I have lived, whenever something was discovered, they thought, boy, this is the chain of man evolving from ape into Homo sapien. Let me go through a number of these real quickly. The one that I'll take a moment here to read about is Neanderthal. And, of course, over there in France, there's a cave where they do a lot of digging and excavating and discovering all these things about Neanderthal, how Neanderthal is an individual, so apparently, who evolved from a lower species into Homo sapien. Is that really true? What does the evidence actually show about Neanderthal? Let me just share with you a little bit. Beginning in the 1950s, however, scholars began to change their minds concerning Neanderthal, especially in view of the fact that similar remains have been discovered in Europe, Africa, and Asia. The evidence now suggests that these were the bones of a hunched-over man who suffered severely from rickets, a disease caused by a severe vitamin D deficiency. This condition causes a softening of the bones as well as defective bone growth. And those who have this disease are characterized by a bulky head, a crooked spine, and limbs, and depressed ribs, among other things. Guess what? You know, the old expression, well, there, he's a real Neanderthal, isn't he? Used in that way. Well, a lot of that kind of expression is out of ignorance, too. The evidence shows that Neanderthal man, when in good health, stood fully erect, walked in a normal fashion with a normal posture like modern humans. He certainly had a fully human brain capacity. The evidence shows that he sewed clothes from animal skins, built shelters, had a form of writing, practiced religious ceremonies, played musical instruments, made and used various tools, including axes, boars, scrapers, points, and knives, fashioned stone arrowheads, used fire for cooking, painted pictures, used language to communicate, buried the dead, and even placed flowers upon graves. Sometimes he buried the dead with various objects, suggesting the possibility that he had some kind of belief in the here in the afterlife. He also displayed social care. Some skeletons show the marks of obvious injuries or illnesses suffered sometime before death, evidence that there must have been social care to support certain ailing or disabled individuals. These are not things one would expect of a savage ape-like creature. Clearly, Neanderthal man was a Homo sapien. I have seen a lot of that evidence and so forth in the caves over there in France on TV, and I thought about that. To do all of that, I mean, that's not subhuman. You have an individual here, if they are burying the dead and if they have certain things that indicate that they believe in a hereafter, how can you equate that with a subhuman? Well, they do because they want to, and they're not at all. Let me go down through the list of others that have made the news over the last century. Let's move to Java Man in Indonesia. Well, today they've come to understand that that little skull they found over there is an extinct gibbon and not in any way related to man. The one that was the biggest hoax of them all was Piltdown Man in England in 1912. Piltdown took 50 years, though, to find out and realize that the individuals, the two men who did it, discovered this ape-like creature that became a Homo sapien, as they said at the time. It was an absolute deliberate fraud. And part of the jaw was not even of an ape itself. Peking Man in China. It took a while, but once they finally discovered with Peking Man, the problem was that Peking Man were monkeys that were killed and eaten by workers at a lime quarry. And what they had discovered was the partial skulls of the monkeys at the lime quarry, but they were being eaten because it was a delicacy to eat the brains. It took them several years to figure that out, and it wasn't at that time a quarry that was being worked at all. Another hoax, which came out in the, not as a hoax, but was used in the Scopes trial in Tennessee back in 1926, was Nebraska Man. Nebraska Man, discovered in Nebraska, happened to turn out to be an extinct wild pig. That's right. It was not a full skull. These, by the way, are not complete skulls. These are partial skulls. This is a jaw. And then as we come more up in our time, in my time when I was just a teenager, was East African ape called Zinjanthropus by the Leakey family, a husband and wife who were anthropologists. They discovered, they had finally found the link that man came out of Africa. That was 1959. 1965, they finally discovered, no, it was not linked to man at all. It was an ape. Then later, their son, I forgot his first name, discovered Lucy. Maybe you heard of Lucy in Ethiopia. Guess what? Not right away. Within a few years, as others came along to examine what evidence was supposed to be there, after all the hullabaloo in the papers and everything and the big claims are made, Lucy turned out to be a chimp. Let me read one quote on this, as far as in Rhodes' book, which I thought was very good on this. Despite all the media hoopla about alleged ape men, however, no hard evidence yet exists for their reality. To be sure, we do have lots of fossils and bones of human beings, and we do have lots of fossils and bones of apes, but we do not have any fossils or bones of transitional ape men, nor do we have any fossils demonstrating that human beings and apes derived from a common ancestor. The fossil record seems to indicate that apes have always been apes and humans have always been humans. Though evolutionists do not want to hear it, this is perfectly compatible with what the Bible teaches regarding creationism. And if somebody disagrees, let's see your evidence. And that's what stops people right there. This is a major, a lot of this type of thing of finding ape-like creatures that were supposed to be the stepping stone to man is nothing more than a fraud in many cases. And trying to make something out of nothing, really, when there's nothing there whatsoever. All right, I do want to stop. That should cover most of the major areas of flaws that would, there's many, many things you could go into. But when you look at this, no mutations have changed from one species to the other. These, quote, ape man to human beings is actually a fraud. It's not true at all, and there's never been any evidence to show that. Or the most important one, intermediate species, which, of course, do not exist. But always begin by realizing you're dealing not with science, but philosophy. People whose philosophy, because they don't even realize themselves that their carnal mind is enmity toward God, and the human mind, their human mind, is deceitful above all things. They think they're intellectual. They think they're smart because they believe in this philosophy. And they really do not. They don't understand. Let's go over here to Romans chapter 1 real quickly. Romans 1, verses 20 through 22. In verse 20, for since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools. Now they think they're brilliant. God says they become fools and cling to a philosophy that cannot be scientifically demonstrated or proven. Notice in the Old Testament, because it's not only in our time and generation that you find this, but if you go to Proverbs 14, Proverbs the 14th chapter, or the 14th proverb, I guess it'd be more correct. David said it very well. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They have done abominable works. There is none who does good. Now this is repeated in Psalm 53 and in verse 1. So twice you see this. Only the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. And we have a lot of people today, and this is, of course, God is to be put out of schools, put out of everything in our society. And court cases, they continue. The ones who come up with the court cases to get God out of this or get God out of that seem to win. Continually winning. Yes, I think as parents, certainly we all have to be aware of how we will deal with that, because when our son or daughter comes home, they've heard that at school, but they hear the opposite at church. And then, too, also parents have to deal with it from time to time themselves with other adults when it may come up. Now let me switch gears here a little bit. We've been looking so far at about five of the major areas of problem for evolution that simply are glossed over by evolutionists and not really dealt with at all. But now if we switch gears a little bit and start to look at some of the evidence of God. In 1960, the church published an article entitled Seven Proofs God Exists. I believe today that the evidence to support those seven proofs is greater than when the article was written. And that's why I thought we could go all night and all this coming week if we want to go through all of the things that are physical evidences that God exists. But I do think that if we hit these seven proofs that were given back in 1960 in that article, you can take it from there and you can begin to increase upon it in your own reading as well. The first proof that was given is that law requires a lawgiver. Law requires a lawgiver. Everything that we are doing, sitting here comfortably in our chair, is governed by law. We're governed by the law of gravity. Do you know what gravity is? You know what it does. If I step off the stage, I'm not going to go up, am I? I'm going to go straight down. Works every time, doesn't it? What's keeping that law? Why is it there? Why is that law there? Everything that we do in our physical life is governed by physical laws. I'm just talking physical laws now because, of course, spiritual laws, which you have right here in the Bible, and many of those things also govern our physical life. But just look at the physical laws, the physical universe. Everything out there is governed by law. The very fact that we, as a planet, are the distance we are from the sun, not any closer, not any further away. Because if it were either way, it could not support life. And it goes around constantly in its orbit and has for millenniums and millenniums, who knows, maybe millions of years. I don't know when God created the earth. And the moon. The moon is the exact distance away from the earth. If it were any closer, the tides would flood everybody. And if it were, what, any further away, it would be just in the opposite. And yet it's constant in its orbit around the earth. Everything is in perfect harmony. The earth with the sun and its moon, its position in the Milky Way galaxy is perfect. If it were in any other position of this particular galaxy, we would not be here. We could not survive. When you study and look at the Milky Way, where our position is, it's not time and chance. It is intelligent design. Everything is perfect. Laws. Everything is based and follows law, physical and spiritual. In James chapter 4, we even see this interesting comment here that goes right along with this. James 4 and in verse 12. There is one lawgiver who is able to save and to destroy, and who are you to judge another? Yes, there is one lawgiver, God. And he has created, of course, James is talking about spiritually here, but physically, all the laws that he has created to govern everything that we see about us. There are many, many things we can look at as to all the different laws that exist so that we can exist. But one of the first obvious proofs, where did all of these laws that look, scientists who want to shoot a man to the moon or an object out in space, they have to understand these laws. If they want to break these laws that govern everything in the physical universe, and they'll never succeed. They know that. And when we have had disasters, laws were broken. Very simple. And not intentionally, but accidentally. And we know the results of what has happened. There is a great lawgiver who has given law. Everything follows constant law. It's in perfect harmony. The second of those seven proofs, life requires a life giver. The law of biogenesis, which you don't hear a lot about, bio means life, genesis, beginning, the beginning of life. Life can only come from life. I find that very interesting. When I read some of these books and I see some of the things that some of the noted world evolutionists, whether it's Richard Dawkins or Stephen Jay Gould or whoever the pronouncements are, I can't think of the name right now, the British guys of a few years ago, they're dead now. And when you look at the law of biogenesis, and these people can be so smug and think that they really understand everything, I just have one thing to say. Let's see you make life. You understand DNA? You understand all the things of a cell? Put it together, make it live, and make it reproduce. Let's see you do it. Let's see you do it. Aren't you smart enough to do that? You cannot create. You cannot even make it. And then if you do even put it together and you think you have it all right, make it live and make it reproduce itself. That's what has to happen, right? In order to come out to the entire plant kingdom on this earth, the entire animal kingdom, all began when chemicals happened to mix together just right. Here you have these people going up there. We put probes on Mars. They're digging in there with a little shovel to see if they can find water, ice. Why? Because that might mean that life has evolved there, microscopic life of some sort. Well, if that's the case, can't you create it? Can't you make it? Why can't you? No, they just they can't face that at all. Notice here in Genesis chapter 2, in Genesis 2 and verse 7. And the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being. God is the life giver and has made man able to do the. Man has life because God breathed in him the breath of life. Look, there has to be a spirit component to life in some way. You can make cells if you think you're smart enough. I mean, if you have enough knowledge that you know what everything, you can construct it, but you cannot make it live. And you certainly cannot make it reproduce itself. You have to do that if you're going to try to explain the entire plant kingdom of the earth, the entire animal kingdom of the earth. All the complex organs as well that we just take for granted. Those things could, the mutations, as they would explain it, they don't tell you it takes 3 trillion mutations for a human being to finally develop into the eye in a human being. That is a phenomenal thing. When you look at this, I'm reminded of 1 Kings 18. I won't turn to it because of time, and I'll just mention here. In 1 Kings 18, Elijah the prophet had a run-in with Ahab's prophets of Baal, 450 of them on Mount Carmel in northern Israel. So he said, look, I want to decide whether your God can burn this offering by fire supernaturally or the God I serve. And so they, went through their cantations and everything, even slapping themselves with things that tore their flesh and bleeding and all that. Around noontime, he said, well, what's happened here? This is 1 Kings 18, about verse 27. What's happened here, fellas? Has your God, has he gone somewhere? Is he taking a nap? I mean, he began to make fun of them. And, of course, you know the rest of the story. He said, now step aside, fellows. I want you to pour water on this offering. I want this whole offering, I want everything here just covered with water. And then I'm going to pray to my God, and he's going to light this thing up, and you know the rest of the story. But what did he say to Israel? There in chapter 18, about verse 20 or 21. Well, I have it written down here. It's 21. Who are you going to obey today, Israel? What are you going to believe, we could say today? Which way you want to go? Here, okay, you've seen, you look at the facts. You know, put before you a decision to make here today. Well, it's, you know, I think about that in terms of in our modern day. That's really not too outdated, is it? Not really too outdated. You have 1 Kings 18, verse 21, 22 there. The third law was creation requires a creator. It absolutely does. You cannot explain creation by evolution. It's got too many problems. It's impossible. The fourth one was sustaining requires a sustainer. Everything is sustained. You know, the Bible talks about God sustaining. Let's take a look at that. Acts 14. I didn't think about this when we were covering this in Bible study, that is Acts, the book of Acts, but right here it is. You know, you can read things and later you come back to it when you're focused on a different subject and you see it right there. But in Acts chapter 14, verse 16 and 17, verse 16, who in bygone generations allowed all nations to walk in their own ways? Nevertheless, he did not leave himself without witness, in that he did good, gave us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with good and gladness. The point here is, he sustained us. God sustained us. Chapter 17, you see it again. In chapter 17, verse 24 through 28, God who made the world and everything in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he worshipped with men's hands, as though he needed anything, since he gives to all life, breath, and all things. And he has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings, so that they should not should seek the Lord in the hope that they might grope for him, find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as also some of your own poets have said, for we are also his offspring. As verse 28 shows, look, in him, in God, we live. He sustains. We move and have our being. He not only does he sustain our life, he sustains everything around us. He is the sustainer. The fifth proof that was listed there in 1960, design requires a designer. Today, we call it intelligent design, don't we? And it is very intelligent. You know, if you want to show an individual how plain it is, as a few moments ago I said, if you can create life, why don't you do it? Show it to us. That should tell you that there is something far more intelligent that has made you, because you cannot do that. Our minds are incredibly intelligent. Psalm 19, David recognized and saw this. It, of course, before God, it's nothing. But it is in comparison to everything else physically on this earth. In Psalm 19, verse 1, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. And going on to explain it, day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. Yes, when you look at everything that God has made, it declares God's glory. And it's incredible when we study and see those things. It can only come about by what is called intelligent design, and that, of course, is God. You know, that's why that they do not like anyone who believes in intelligent design to teach in colleges and universities. Push them out the door. That's religion. We can't have religion here. We're scientists. That is not true. No, that is, of course, refusing to look at all the evidence. The last two, which are also very important, but of course people who have already set their heart into not believing in God would not probably see much in it. The number six was fulfilled Bible prophecy. Fulfilled Bible prophecy. You're going through the book of Daniel. Many of those prophecies have been already fulfilled. And we're going to be coming to the 70 weeks prophecy when we get to chapter 9. That is the most incredible prophecy, fulfilled right down to the exact year when Jesus Christ began his ministry. Each of those days of the 70 weeks was as a year. And it was exactly from the time of the giving of that proclamation to go back and build the walls of Jerusalem in 457 to the beginning of his ministry, 483 years later, the fall of 27 AD. We're not the only ones that see that. As I mentioned to you before, I have it and can read it to you right out of the expositor's Bible commentary, that it says that as well. And finally, the last one, which only those who already have proven in their mind and in their heart and they know God does exist, and that is answered prayer proves God's existence. And when we see and we pray and we go to God and we begin to really humble ourselves, become before him and ask for his intervention and help, and we see it come, we know that was not just luck. That was not time and chance. There is, as Churchill said, an invisible hand here that is guiding and directing everything and who also is answering prayer. Yes, these seven proofs are not out of date. They are even more up to date, I believe, than when we wrote them in 1960. Law requires a lawgiver. Life requires a life giver. Creation requires a creator. Sustaining requires a sustainer. Design requires a great designer. Fulfilled prophecy and answered prayer. I want to end by going to 1 Peter chapter 3. 1 Peter chapter 3. And in verse 15. But sanctify the Lord God in your hearts and always be ready to give a defense to everyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you with meekness and with fear, as he said. Brethren, I hope this helps us to be aware of the major problems with evolution and to appreciate the wonderful proofs for God.